Good evening, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I am your host, Lance White. Tonight's guest is a longtime friend, Valentine Riddell. Valentine is the founder and executive director of Orenda Healing International, a nonprofit organization devoted to promoting individual and community health and well-being. She has taught art making to young people and adults since 1965, and a unique form of art called healing art, which is a blend of shamanism and art making, which she developed in 1984 to heal herself of cancer. She uses for AIDS and cancer patients, the incarcerated, homeless, and at-risk youth, also with the developmentally disabled and women in transition. She is also a certified Reiki master. She maintains a private practice in holistic counseling and shamanic healing in Berkeley, California, where she and her husband, Louis Riddell, share their home with two cats, several raccoons and skunks, and an amazing number of squirrels, birds, and other urban wildlife. In her free time, she writes fantasy for teens and visits with her two adult daughters and five grandchildren. Let's welcome Valentine to the show now. Hi, Valentine. How are you?
Hi, Lance. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm pretty good. You know, I probably will never get this opportunity to explain this again, so I'm going to ask you if you remember... You're really responsible for creating that moniker of mine called Zany Mystic. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. How did that happen?
You don't. Well, people ask me where I come up with this name, and I guess I'll remind you. Valentine goes back, you and I go back about 30 or 35 years ago, don't we?
Yeah, just about.
Yeah, and I think it was about 7 or 8 years ago that you empowered me or invited me to become a member of the healing group, the Healing Friends.
Yeah.
And I tend to be a little bit on the zany side, and one day you wrote a reply. You wrote to about one of my emails. You said, you know, Lance, you're just a zany mystic.
Is that where you got it?
Yes, and that's where I got the zany mystic. And so I used that on the show. I used it in my book, and, you know, and everybody likes it. So now I can't use my real name, Lance. But it doesn't really matter. We're just wandering spirits anyway. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It fits.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. You're probably one of the most interesting people I've ever known. And, you know, on so many different levels, and we might not get to tap into all of these experiences, but I'd like to focus on your spiritual background, and maybe you could briefly... tell the listeners about your experience, some of your experiences that have shaped you and brought you to the point you're at today.
All right. Well, I'll be very brief. I was raised a Roman Catholic, and at the age of 14, I decided the whole thing was hypocritical and left the church, and then had this sort of adversarial relationship with God for about the next 30-odd years. And then I began to sort of drift back, but it wasn't towards the church. It was more towards an earth-based spirituality.
Uh-huh.
I'm part Native American. I'm actually part Apache. And I think that kind of called me.
Mm-hmm.
So I began doing bizarre things like getting up at the crack of dawn, you know, walking up to the top of the hill where we lived in San Francisco and watching the sunrise.
I love it.
And it was dawn, and for me that's weird because dawn is not my best time of the day.
Me neither.
Mm. So anyway, that went on for a while, and then I met my husband, Lou Riddell, and he happened to be interested in the Fellowship of Friends, so I joined that. And we sort of, you know, went along there for a little while, and then we both left.
Yeah.
And we moved up to Mendocino, which is on the North Coast up here. We moved up there, and within just a very, very short time, a matter of months, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and I thought, oh, great, lovely, you know, no medical insurance, not much money, no guts. Didn't want to go through the medical model. But I had been trained as an artist, and in a very strange way, had learned that art is a way of kind of tapping into the spiritual, and especially through nature.
Oh, yeah.
And so I just did all sorts of very strange things. I started just making images of what I thought ovarian cancer would look like, and then discovered during a visit to a chiropractor that I actually also had scoliosis, which upset me more than the cancer, because scoliosis is visible, cancer is not. Talk about vanity. So I made a sculpture of a twisted spine, and then, talking to a friend, I was telling him what was going on and what was not going on in my life, and he said, well, you know what, here's a little book on Huna, which is the Hawaiian science of healing and magic, and why don't you read it? So I read it, and it said, whatever you put out in the universe comes back to you. And I looked at my little twisty spine, and I thought, whoops. So I made a straight one. And on a visit to the chiropractor, about 6 weeks after that, he said, what are you doing? What have you been doing? I said, I've been doing everything you told me to do, nothing else, I swear. And he said, yes, but your back is straightening out. You had a 25-degree scoliosis, and now it's almost gone. And I said, is this possible? And he said, I don't know, but it's happening to you. And he said, what happened? What did you do? And I said, I can't think of anything I did except make two sculptures. He said, well, go home and make more sculptures. It's working. So I went home, and I thought, if it works for this, maybe it will work for the cancer, too. So I started making those kinds of things. Pelvic cast, you know, with weird things tacked on that looked like, I thought, if you had to look at something like ovarian cancer, it would look. And then quickly making another cast with beautiful mylar stars in those places and gorgeous colors and all of this. And it kind of, I don't know how to describe it other than to say it gave my inner self, the part of me that runs the body, if you will, a message saying, hey, we want to live. And along with that, there came a sort of a very deep introspection into how did this happen in the first place. And I realized that one of the reasons it may have happened is because I'd had a really adversarial relationship with my mother and a difficult relationship with my daughters, and I began to look at that and sort of take responsibility for those things. And the pièce de résistance that I have to share with you and with your listeners is that at some point along the way, I had gone to a friend's house for a psychodrama session, and it had been long, and I was tired, and I went home and went to bed, and the next morning I got up, and we were driving, my husband and I, driving down to the Bay Area, and this session had been me sort of switching places between two chairs. In one chair I was me, in the other chair I was my mother. And the only thing that was strange and interesting that I noticed was that in the mother chair, I would have thoughts and things would be said that weren't my thoughts and weren't my voice and weren't my way of you know, speaking and phrasing. But anyway, we're driving down in our little blue VW bug, and we get to, I guess, Cloverdale. And all of a sudden I thought, this whole crazy relationship with my mom wasn't her fault. It was my fault. It was because I expected her to be a certain way, which she couldn't be. And therefore, I treated her like that. And therefore, and all of a sudden, there was this audible click. I felt something turn. It's the only way to describe it. In my abdomen. And Lewis said, what is that noise? And I said, I don't know, but I felt something move here. And he was driving, and he glanced at me really quickly, and then he said, my God, you look like a completely different person.
Whoa.
And after that, everything began very, very quickly to heal.
Jeez.
And so that brings me to what I'd really like to talk about tonight, which is the power of healing, the power of forgiveness in healing, and particularly in shamanic healing.
Well, I mean, a lot of people have had experiences similar to yours in the sense that they're unusual or miraculous, and it seems that there's a common thread there, that our expectations and our blame and our judgments about our family members or whoever we are holding responsible for the way we are has to be healed.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah. How important is humor and laughter in that process?
Well, if you can't laugh at yourself while you're going through all of this, it's a grim ordeal.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
But not just banal humor, you know. I mean, the humor has got to be pertinent to what's going on with you.
Now, you and I both had active alcoholics in our family, and I spent quite a few years on the bottle and with pills and drugs and various other substances. What is your feeling about why we choose these difficulties, or if we choose them? I mean, it's easy to say, to blame everything else around us and say, well, it's not my fault, but it seems that for me it turned around when I began to take responsibility for all of that.
Exactly. I guess my personal feeling, based on my own experience and on observing my family members, is that any addiction is an attempt to escape pain.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So that takes the blame away right there.
Yeah.
See, a disease like cancer is sort of a self-blame thing. In a way, we are punishing ourselves.
Yes.
Okay, for whatever it is we think we've done wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. If nobody did anything wrong, if what we did was a way to try to avoid pain, you know, in a sort of a, I don't know what to say, childish way, maybe, would be one way of saying it, then there isn't any blame. It's not wrong. It's just something that didn't work.
Yeah.
Okay? So if you can take that, if you can take the onus of blame off of it, then it makes it a lot easier to look at why one has done whatever one has done, whether it worked or didn't work, and sort of open you up to possibilities that might work.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that a lot of people that have difficulties with life-threatening illnesses often have some kind of emotional damage or blockage or very difficult traumatic experiences in childhood, rape, abuse, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
How do people begin to recognize what's on the, you know, what is a blockage, and when it's necessary to go to somebody to get assistance with removing that blockage? I mean, we can do this ourselves, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, we don't really...
Well, ourselves with the help of spirit, yeah.
Right. How do you view spirit as manifesting here?
Well, first of all, I think it has to, you know, there's the expression in Alcoholics Anonymous, where you hit rock bottom.
Yeah.
Okay. In other words, there is no place to go from here except up. There's no further down you can go.
Yeah.
So I work with people as a shamanic and holistic counselor. And what I find with my clients is usually they have gotten to a place where they simply don't know where else to go. The medical model may or may not be working for them. Their jobs aren't working. Their relationships aren't working. Whatever it is, it's not working. And so they basically come wanting something that will work. And the first thing, obviously, that people have to do is acknowledge their own... And responsibility is a heavy word, okay? Because of what we have loaded onto it.
Mm-hmm.
If you break it up into response and then ability, what it means is the ability to respond appropriately to a certain situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's not this heavy burden of whatever, guilt, blame. So what I try to do with folks when they come in this state is show them where they can begin to look for their own input into this particular situation. Not in a blaming way at all, but more in an empowering way. Because, for example, if you are, let's just say you come, all right, and you've got a specific problem, and if you're blaming it on your long-dead parent, that's really disempowering.
Yeah.
Because you can't do a thing about it, and that person's gone.
Yeah.
But if you look at it and you say, okay, fine, here's my part in this, and I can take responsibility for that, and I can change my attitude about this particular thing, then you're empowered. Then you've got, you know, you have the ability to do something.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's kind of like taking your power back, and once you do that, then, you know, one of the things that seems like I have to confront for myself when I do that is my own fears.
Sure.
So,
but wasn't it Nelson Mandela who said it's not our weaknesses that we're afraid of, it's our power
Oh yeah, no question about that.
I can't remember the exact quote, so that's just paraphrased. But basically, that was the message.
Well, you know, I don't know too many people who actually do believe or feel that they're worthy. You know, it seems like there's so much insecurity and self-doubt and self-loathing, and it's a lot of stuff to work through. It really
yeah,
is.
So where do you suppose all that came from?
Well, it seems like it just permeates everything in the physical world.
But it had to start somewhere. Where might that be?
Parents?
Well, that's one. But they came with their load, too.
Yeah. Original evil?
I don't believe in original evil.
I don't either.
That's one of the things I dropped when I left the church.
I don't know. What would you say?
Well, one of the things I'm doing now, because I sincerely believe that you never stop learning as long as you're in a body, you might as well keep learning. So one of the things I'm doing now is reading The Course in Miracles.
Oh, yeah.
All right. And The Course teaches, it's a very interesting thing, because it is put out there for Christians, and I'm not really a Christian.
Uh-huh.
But still, there is truth in it. And one of the things The Course teaches is that there was no original sin. There was simply an original error of judgment. When, at some point, the little piece of us that is God,
mm-hmm.
and this is based upon the theory that it is all one, that there aren't any little, you know, multiple pieces, that we're all one being and that one being is God.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this one little piece just suddenly thought, I wonder what would happen if I just sort of veered off to the side here and did my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, everything that we currently experience as life happened. This earth, our ego, our feeling of separation from God, any guilt we may feel about that, of which all other guilt is just sort of the stepchild, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
And so on and so on. And so if there is original wrong, and I don't like to use the word evil or sin or even wrong, really, but if there was an original error, that was it. But the Course goes on to teach that it's already forgiven. Because as far as God was concerned, none of this happened. This was just something that happened in the mind, if you will, of a little tiny piece of him,
mm-hmm.
or her,
mm-hmm.
however you look at it. And it's not any more real than our dreams.
Well, that makes sense to me. I mean, it seems that the great teachers over the ages have all said basically the same thing, that this is, we're living in the illusion, or Maya,
mm-hmm.
and of course today, the Mayan information seems to be coming to the fore because of the idea that in 2012, as the Mayan calendar ends, and, you know.
Yeah, but that's two different uses of Maya. One was an ancient civilization in the Americas.
Right.
The other is what? Is it a Sanskrit word, a Hindu word? I don't know the language. But it's a word to describe illusion.
Right, that's
so
right.
So it's very different there.
That's right, absolutely right. So, you mentioned also the idea of shamanism.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of research into indigenous shamans today. Can you tell us what is shamanism, so that people understand a little bit better?
Well, I think ancient shamanism, and this is just my understanding of it from being part Native American and also from being what is now being called an urban shaman. Hate that word, but anyway. It makes it sound like we're all sort of cruising around in our cars with our drums or something. But anyway, shamanism was a way of life. It wasn't just a religion. It is in a sense, a part of almost every indigenous culture, in one way or another. And a shaman was basically a healer priest.
Mm-hmm.
It was a person who communicated with spirit on the behalf of the other tribal members.
Okay.
So that's sort of the short and sweet definition of shamanism. And then it would vary for each culture. The one I was first introduced to formally was Huna,
mm-hmm.
which is the Hawaiian shamanism. And then I realized that I had my own, you know, connection through being part Native American to Native American shamanism.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were talking yesterday. We had that dialogue about one of the projects that you're working on with Native Americans, mm-hmm. and I thought this was really fascinating about that part of your work in this new project will be to have the teens make videos of the Native American elders and capture the stories and some of the information that they've passed down throughout the centuries. Could you share about that a little bit?
Sure. The group I'll be working with is the Navajo, and we will be working up in the Four Corners area.
Oh, wow.
We'll be specifically in Shiprock, which is in northwestern New Mexico, but the Navajo reservation is huge, and it really encompasses that whole Four Corners area.
Uh-huh.
So that's, a corner of Colorado, Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico right there where they all meet. And it's very, very, it's the largest reservation in the country. And the people are going through an awful lot of things. Adults are suffering all kinds of degenerative diseases.
Uh-huh.
Heart disease, diabetes, alcoholism, drug abuse, all of this stuff. The kids are going through what white kids are going through, except in their case, Native American kids, apparently teenagers, comprise the highest rate of teen suicides in the country.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't either until I started doing some research. And so what came into my mind, and this was kind of funny because I got called by a group called the, I think it's called CIN, Council of Indian Nations.
Uh-huh.
I guess it was last summer, asking for donations, and I had just gotten out of graduate school with no money, minus money,
yeah.
You know. And I said, well, you know what, I don't have any money, but I've got a nonprofit organization and some ideas, so maybe I could help that way. So this person gave me the name of a person who never called back. But meanwhile, I went down to talk to a friend of mine here in the Bay Area who is Native American and talked to her about this thought that I had. And she said, well, here, let me put you in contact with, you know, so-and-so. And this is her friend on the Navajo reservation.
Uh-huh.
So I called him, and we got to talking, and this project has evolved from that. But what it basically is Native American adolescents, ages 14 to 18, will be interviewing Navajo elders, and this means like their grandparents' ages.
Right, right.
And hopefully hearing teaching stories and tribal history and personal history and things that will be really helpful to them.
Mm-hmm.
Things which now they may not be hearing because they're sort of, you know, being pulled between two worlds. Their world, which is based on the Beauty Way, which is very similar, as a matter of fact, to the Course of Miracles and to all of the really high teachings, high mm-hmm. spiritual teachings, and the White Way, which is all about, you know, greed and, you know, what's for me.
Scandals.
All of that,
yeah,
you know.
Really.
So this is a terrible place to be, torn in the middle like that. And so what we're hoping is this will help those kids kind of get a grip on their own culture.
Wow.
It will also help the elders realize how valid their information is and how important it is to have shared it and, in a sense, validate their life experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then other things that seem to be coming up, because I guess I am calling him my tribal liaison on the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
When I first mentioned this to him, said, well, if we're going to do this, why don't we make a movie? I have never made a movie, right? So I thought, ooh, what fun. Let's do make a movie. So this has gotten us involved with the Santa Fe Community College, with the Institute of American Indian Arts. Both of these are in Santa Fe. With my school, the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, where I teach in the global program.
Okay.
In the global PhD program. We've got a student coming from Whittier College in Southern California. We've got one of my students in the global program coming from Australia. So there are like a whole bunch of people somehow being drawn to this to participate in various ways. And I am feeling that the Anglo folks, that is to say Caucasian folks, who participate in this will learn something just invaluable for them as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And then, you know, God willing, we'll make a movie that's really worthwhile. Maybe, you know, we can show it on PBS.
Well, that would be wonderful.
Anyway, this is how it's evolving. And I'm very excited. Everybody's excited. And we're just, you know, we're going to start on July 7th. And this first phase of it will run through July 25th. And then phase two, of course, will be the post-production and editing and all of that. And then phase three will be dissemination of this thing, getting it out to the public.
Mm-hmm. I would love to see something like that myself, because I must have some Native American blood in me, because I've always felt attracted to the gentleness and the connection with nature.
Mm-hmm.
And the myth and the metaphor, you know, the storytelling, and there's so much that seems like it could be lost of great value to us, you know, in our rush to get nowhere fast.
Well, it is being lost. That's the tragedy.
Yeah, yes.
I mean, this is the thing I learned when I was studying Huna. The secret, if you want to call it a secret, or the core, the kernel of the spiritual teaching,
mm-hmm.
is in the language.
Mm.
It's in the language. Mm. And this is so for the Navajo as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the Beauty Way is incredible, Lance. Just the little bit that I'm learning about it is so just amazing. It is actually, there's a wonderful book by a man named, I believe it's Peter Gold, which compares Navajo Beauty Way with Tibetan Buddhism.
Ooh, ooh.
And there is a very strong comparison. Very
wow.
strong comparison.
Oh, I've got to get that one.
Yeah, I'll get you the title.
That'd be great. There's a couple of things that came to mind real quickly. One is that Joseph Campbell talks a lot about the importance of myth,
mm-hmm.
and of keeping that tradition alive. And you know, I think you quote him on your website, don't you?
Where?
Oh, no, you don't. I thought you did. I may have, but is there somewhere there's a quote by Peter?
Well, there's probably a quote by him in the dissertation, which is on the website.
That was it. I started reading that. I didn't get through the whole thing, but that was an interesting piece of writing.
Thanks.
Very
that
nice.
Was a lot of work, let me tell you.
I bet. I bet.
I have students now who gripe and moan, you know, about where the periods and the quotation marks and all the rest of it are going. And I finally got my bound copy back.
Huh.
And the research assistant who handed it to me said, oh, what are you going to do with this? Take it home, put it in a special box. I said, absolutely not. I'm going to put it on my desk, and when my students call and start to gripe about the things they need to write and the way they need to write them, I'm going to wave it in their faces and say, I had to do it, and so do you.
Good for you. Good for you. You mentioned also about languaging.
Yes.
And I felt, in my own approach to healing work, that people that were picking up the wrong language when we use ideas that are adversarial, like fighting cancer.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Fighting AIDS. Everything is a battle.
Think of that. Yes.
Yeah. And you know that I've been HIV positive for about 24 years now.
Right.
And, you know, diagnosed with AIDS for about 5 or 6 years. And I haven't done anything really that's been proactive to live that long with a potentially dangerous disease.
But here you are.
And here I am. And so, you know, for me it was almost like my own realization was, you know, no matter what I did to my body to abuse it, I must be here for a reason.
I think that's true. But I also think, this is something else that the Course is talking about. Bodies are something that, in a sense, our egos have created to serve our own purpose.
Oh, okay.
So our bodies can be healthy or well. But what we have to come to in our realization is, which is stronger? Is it the body or the mind?
Huh.
Now, remember, the mind is part of universal mind. Okay?
Okay.
Universal mind is one way to look at it, okay? Or God's mind, if you will, however
okay.
you want to put that.
Okay.
So how can a body, I mean, look how fragile they are, right? You fall down on something hard and you break a bone.
You get an owie.
Yeah, or whatever. How can a body be stronger than that? So why should we feel that we are at the mercy of anything?
Yeah.
when really the truth is that our minds can control this.
Hmm.
This is just a way to look at it. It's something to consider. I propose it to my clients when I feel that they're ready, you know, to look at it that way.
Uh-huh.
It's a hard concept because this is not what we've been taught. And God bless them, you know, allopathic medicine does not, it certainly doesn't support this view.
Well, you know, it really is all tied up in the idea of, you know, the body-mind-spirit heart connection, isn't it?
Except that you're saying it as if those things were separate, and what I am coming to understand
is it's one.
Is that it's one, and that one is spirit, and everything else is how spirit manifests.
Hmm.
And spirit, let's put it this way. Spirit for you has now manifested in the body that you look at when you are, you know, washing your face and brushing your teeth in the morning in the mirror, right?
Right, or trying to avoid that mirror.
Or whatever.
Right.
It's your thoughts.
Right.
It is the things that you have considered make up who you are.
Right.
Right. It's your life's work, whatever that may be. It is the summation of all of your life experiences. Okay?
Okay.
So all of these things are somehow how spirit has manifested for you. But above and beyond all of it, there is spirit. And spirit is always, it's just always. There isn't any beginning or any end. There isn't any death because spirits can't die.
And there's no birth.
And there's no real birth. That's an illusion too.
Right.
So everything that we see out here, and this to me is quite fascinating, and it's a difficult thought too. Everything I'm looking at right now, and I'm sitting in my backyard, and I'm looking at sun shining on a bird feeder, and lots of green leafy things, everything is a projection of something in me.
I'm following you. Elaborate on that a little bit more.
I'm not sure I'm even following myself. But
yeah.
This is what I'm coming to understand.
Okay, all right.
If I look, let's say I look out at all these leafy greens, and the thought that I have is, oh my God, I feel so claustrophobic. I can't stand being surrounded by all this greenery. I can't breathe. Let me out of here. That's a viewpoint. It's a projection, right?
Yes.
On the other hand, I look out and I say, isn't this beautiful? Look at the sun on the leaves. Look at the birds that just flew by. You know, look at the little squirrel there on the branch. That's a whole other projection.
Right.
Okay? Nothing has changed except my thought about it. It's
okay.
All the same thing.
That's right. That's right.
Okay? Does that make any sense?
Yes. Now, let's keep going with that one.
All right. So let's take a hard one here.
Yes.
How about I look at Bush, right?
Yeah. How about that?
And I think about all the things that I have been thinking about Bush, none of which are particularly complimentary.
Agreed.
Right. And the more I think about that, the more that he becomes in my mind, right?
Right.
Okay. Until he becomes sort of like the archenemy. And I can't even think about
one.
It anymore because it's so awful. You know, it's so overwhelming.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
Then on the other hand, what if I look at him and I go, here's a person who is so wounded that the only way he can be comfortable in the world is to have everything. To not share anything.
Right.
To surround himself with, you know, whatever he needs to surround himself with to feel safe from who knows what. You know, there's
right.
nothing out there really to threaten him, but this is how he feels. Terrorist, if you will, or whatever. And that's a sad and wounded person. You know, okay, that makes a whole different viewpoint of this person. So then he doesn't have to be my enemy. He just has to be a sad and wounded person that I really don't need to pay a whole lot of attention to. Because
okay.
I can't help him unless he comes and asks for it.
Right, right.
But I could send, you know, hopeful and healing thoughts and stuff like that, and maybe it would help.
Now, what about the idea that everything outside of us that we see, perceive as being outside of us is not really outside at all?
I don't think it is.
No.
Well, that's what a projection is. A projection
right.
is kind of like, well, it's a projection. It's like a movie. You know, that you project onto a screen.
Right.
But it's coming from a tape, right? Or in the case of movies today, from a digital file.
Right.
It's not on the screen. It's just being projected from that file or from that tape onto the screen.
That's right.
So the same thing could be true here of us. What we see isn't there. It's just not there. It's like coming out of us and being projected on this screen, which we call the world.
I think where we all have a difficulty with that thought is that we don't know how to relate to something that we feel affects ourselves personally and which impacts so many people in a negative manner and which utilizes so many resources and in the process destroys the planet as well. How active is it necessary to be? We can't all just say, well, Bush is a wounded person and I forgive him. And you
but
know.
What if we did? No. What if there weren't any Bush, right?
Right.
What if Bush were the projection of that frightened, anxious, greedy part of ourselves?
Yeah.
Which we'll call the ego, right?
Right, right.
Right. So what if Bush were that? Just suppose.
Okay.
And what if we did forgive him or it? And really, I mean, really forgive it and really let it go. It simply wouldn't exist anymore, would it?
Well,
and the reason I'm saying this is because when I was able to say about my mother, she was who she was. She couldn't have been anything else. She couldn't have been any other way. It ended. It stopped. All of the angst, all of the anger, all of the resentment, all of the feelings I'd had for all of those years, and mind you, by then it was like 41 or 42, stopped. It was as if they had never been.
Well, I totally agree with you on that one. And
so how would it be different with somebody like a Bush, you know, or a Cheney or a whoever, except that they've sort of made it a little bit more difficult in terms of what precisely they are doing?
Well, they're creating a lot of fear. I think that's the problem.
They are doing what they're doing. We are feeling a lot of fear.
You're right. Yeah, exactly. Thank you for clarifying that for me. You know, there's that languaging thing again, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
they're doing it to us and so on and so forth.
They're doing it for themselves.
Exactly.
Whatever they appear to be doing to us or to anyone is for themselves. This is how people are.
Yeah.
This is what ego is.
Yeah.
We don't think of others. We think of ourselves. That's what the ego does.
Mm-hmm.
That's its game plan.
So it's kind of what you're saying is that part of what creates change, if I'm reading this correctly, is that shifting from self-serving behavior to serving or assisting other people requires working on ego to some extent, if not a lot, and possibly focusing from the heart and the right brain, the intuitive part. Is that something, does that resonate at
all?
Yeah,
except that sort of partitioning something which is a little bit more holistic. And the way I would look at it holistically, I guess, is to look out, as I'm looking now, on my garden,
mm-hmm.
and thinking to myself, okay, here's this marvelous tree. I call her the Grandmother Olive, and she's in my dissertation with photos, no less. And she's really part of me. And she's here because I need a big olive tree in my life right now.
Right, right.
I need birds and squirrels and green stuff.
Right.
And sun and some slightly warm weather.
And maybe a skunk or two.
And a skunk or two. And so, for whatever the reasons, I have put energy into contributing to the manifestation of this.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
Now, I can put my energy here, or I can take my energy and go up to the Berkeley campus.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, hop up on a dais. And start waving slogans and red flags and hopefully not get shot. And start yelling about, you know, how much I hate Bush and Cheney and how this all has to change. And by God, I hope Obama does his job and so on and so on. You know? But that isn't going to serve me. And it's not going to serve anybody else because it's polarizing.
Yeah.
It is something which is separating good, in quotes, right?
Right.
From evil, in quotes, which is a polarization.
Yeah.
And if you take good and evil out of it, and you just go, you know, projection, if that's the word you use instead,
mm-hmm.
then the responsibility for what you're observing, what you're experiencing, and what you will observe and experience comes back to you.
Yeah.
And that may sound like an overwhelming burden, but truly it's not.
Well, we must be creating this shared projection for a reason.
I don't know. Is there any reason?
Or maybe not. Maybe not.
If the ego is this little rebellious part, let's just say it is, that thinks that it's bigger than God.
Right.
And it wants to, now that it's thought this, it feels a little bit guilty, right? And it wants to hide and protect itself.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll do anything to do that.
Yeah.
Won't it?
Yeah.
Have you ever been around little kids?
Oh, yeah.
Well, so you know how it is when a three-year-old's done something that they don't think they maybe should have done?
Yes.
Okay. Don't they just practically stand on their heads to let you know that they didn't do it?
Yes, yes, of course.
They're protecting themselves, right?
That's right.
Okay,
that's right.
So I think that's kind of where our egos are.
Yeah, yeah.
There's this little childish, and not childlike, mind you, but childish, rebellious part.
Mm-hmm.
That would rather die and rather have you die than give up, you know, the concept that it's right and everything else is wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Think about that
right.
For a minute, because that's an important thought.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely right. Well,
So then the question is it worth it? Do we really want to, like, buy into this?
Well, then how do we learn what to do in life? I mean, how can we get in touch with that guiding motivation? You know, what is it that guides us? Why are we here? What are we doing?
I think we've got to stop doing. I don't mean stop everything. I don't mean like stop bathing and brushing your teeth and going to work.
Yeah.
I mean, stop trying to control everything.
Oh, I agree with you on that
okay?
one. 1,000%.
Just realize that we're not in control. We have never been in control.
Yep.
We are being breathed, literally.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
Something else, something higher is in control.
Yeah.
And maybe just turning over control or the concept or the illusion, let us say, of control to that higher the energy.
Yeah, yeah.
Honestly, I get up in the morning. This is what I do now. And I'm 65 years old, right? So it's taken years to get here.
Oh, my goodness.
So anyway, here I am. I get up in the morning, and the first thing I say is, all right, what do you want me to do today?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not kidding you.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding.
I like that.
Because there are so many things that come up. There's so many things that my ego wants to do or thinks it wants to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're all, you know, none of them is, like, bad, but they're all pretty much self-serving, and they're into control because I'm a control freak, right?
Right, right.
And all of this is like running, and then suddenly if I stop and I say, wait, what do you want me to do today? And when I say you, I'm talking to spirit, my higher self, if you will, or God, or whatever.
Okay.
And then if I just be quiet for a few minutes, the whatever sort of presents itself.
Hmm.
And that's a pretty easy way to live your life, you know?
Yes, it is easy.
Then you don't have to struggle. You don't have to suffer. If something happens that you didn't like, you can just say, well, whoops. If something happens that you do like, you go, wonderful.
Yeah.
A miracle.
Yeah.
You know?
What do you think it is that we have some days that are just so synchronistic and perfect? I mean, every moment seems to be sculpted like a Michelangelo statue, and then other days just seem to suck.
Well, I think it's because on those really wonderful days, we've kind of given up control.
That could be.
And on the other days, we're still clinging desperately.
Yeah.
You know, to the illusion that we're in charge of everything, including God.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, things are going to suck.
How has your concept of God shifted over the years?
It shifted a lot. I actually went through a period of studying witchcraft and Wicca.
Uh-huh.
I have been a feminist, but not in a violent way, more in a sort of let's re-empower women way.
And maybe as a part of the goddess?
I think so, yeah absolutely.
Yeah.
For a very long time. But now I'm looking at more of what Rhian Eisler calls the partnership society.
Yes.
Where men and women have equal and complementary roles to play. And we can't spend our time and energy, you know, dissing each other.
Yep.
Because it's really not going to accomplish a thing.
Yep, yep.
And this does not matter. It doesn't, I mean, gender and gender identification do not matter here. The masculine and the feminine have to come together into a oneness because they are complementary aspects. This is something, too, that in what I'm reading, the Beauty Way discusses. And many Native American and other indigenous traditions go into this. Masculine and feminine are yin-yang, part of a whole. And each is vital, each is important, and each has a role to play. So for a while, I was very, very much into feminism in a kind of a down-with-men way. And then I sort of began to move gradually into this more partnership viewpoint, which is a lot more comfortable.
Yes. How do we begin to create more balance internally between the left brain, the male-dominated side, and the intuitive side? And I've heard that when we do become more balanced, there's kind of a switch that gets switched on in our internal electrical circuits that allows us to reach higher intuitive states. What do you think about that?
I've not looked at it that way, but I think, did you by any chance see the video, it was on YouTube, of the neurological scientist?
Yes, yes.
So you saw that?
Yes.
Okay, so that was fascinating.
Yes.
Anyway, what was her name, Jill, was it Bolton?
Yes,
I'm trying to think of her last name. In any event, I thought it was a fascinating thing.
That is really a powerful.
If a part of you's got to go, you know, let it not be the right brain, right?
Yes. Yes, amazing.
Isn't it? But
just for listeners, refresh my memory and just share what it is that she was.
She had a stroke.
Yeah.
She was a neurological scientist, and she had a stroke. And the thing is, she was able to observe, and actually chronicle the process as she went through it.
That's right. That's
and the most wonderful part about it was, I mean, to my mind, right, the most wonderful part was that it was her thinking, planning, counting part that went defunct.
Right.
And the intuitive part expanded, and she said she was standing in the shower, and suddenly she realized that the molecules of her arm and the molecules of the shower were the same. There was no difference. And she, at that moment, thought, oh, my God, I'm having a stroke.
Uh-huh. And she was a neurologist.
Yes.
And so she
and
was
it
able
took
to...
her 8 years to get everything back functioning together.
Amazing.
But for that time, while she was going through this, she was totally in her creative brain, in her intuitive brain. And what she experienced was what I think the Course is talking about. It was total oneness with all that is.
Yeah.
Go back now and rephrase your question. Tell me again your question before we got off on Jill.
Oh, well, I was asking about how to create balance, but we're already balanced.
We're already balanced, but we don't know it. That's the trick.
Maybe the better question is, how do we shed our illusions about what is?
Are we willing to shed them? That's the first question.
Well, you're not willing to know the truth.
There you go. Are you actually willing to take a chance?
Can you take the chance? Yeah.
Because it's a chance.
Something's got to give because, it just seems like whatever we as a unit are doing hasn't been working and isn't working today. For instance, you know, we're talking about oneness now, and if we really got that at the deepest core level, then there are no enemies.
That's exactly true.
There's nobody to fight
impossible.
With. There's no evil axis. There
you
only...
go. There's no. You were talking yesterday about entities. There aren't any.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of people, you know, in the various groups that I'm in, do believe those things are true, and they work with clearing demons and dark energies and reptilians and the rest of it.
I know, but God, how exhausting. Think of it. You spend all this time, you know, trying to believe that you push energy around, please.
Yeah, and what you said, and what I believe makes more sense to me anyway, that those are just ways that we look at things that we use to deal with different energies, and we just put labels on them.
I think that these are ways of distancing responsibility
from
ourselves.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a bad way.
Yeah.
I told you I work as a shaman. I do.
Yeah.
And every now and then, you know, folks will call and they'll say, "Hey, I've got, you know, evil spirits in my house. Can you help?"
Yeah.
And I'll go over, you know, with my drum and my sage and all the rest of it, and we'll go around. But what really is going on is these folks have got some very negative mindsets.
Yes, yes.
And while we're doing the saging and the drumming and the what have you,
yes,
I talk with them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And we find out stuff. We find out, yeah, well, you know, my relationship with my mother was horrible or whatever, or I'm irresponsible and I didn't lock my door or God knows what all. But the point is, it isn't, there is no there. There isn't anything out there that's going to get you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The gitches are in here.
Yeah.
That's what we have to learn and understand and accept.
Yeah.
Because then we have control. Then we can say, when a getcha comes up in the form of an imaginary entity,
yeah,
we can say, "I'm sorry, I don't believe in you. Move over. I am moving forward here."
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we do that in our dreams, and it's pretty easy to do. So.
Sure, and this is just one more dream.
Yeah, thank you.
It is.
And sometimes it seems more like a nightmare, but...
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, we have that kind too. Wouldn't it be interesting to wake up from all of them?
Oh.
How would that be? Wouldn't that be quite amazing?
I keep hoping that that's the direction I keep hoping that it's possible and that it will happen.
I'm sure it's possible and I'm sure it will happen, and the question is just when. I mean, I don't think we've really got any choice. We're all headed there, including the Bushes and the Cheneys and the whoever's.
It sure seems that way, doesn't it?
There's no place else to go.
Yeah, I mean, we've really, as a body, we've backed ourselves into the corner, and now it's almost as if we're going to sink or swim.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that I do that, in the healing process that we do this to ourselves. That when we, for instance, when we want to get out of work, instead of being honest about it, what I used to do was I just would make myself literally ill.
I have to share a funny story with you.
Yeah.
In between marriages, I was dating a much, much older man, and he was a dear soul, and he wanted me to marry him, and something in me sort of thought, I don't think that's a good idea. No, anyway, he went back east to visit family, and I was supposed to hop on a plane and go join him and meet the family and the whole thing. And the morning of the plane trip, I woke up with the most horrible flu. I mean flu. I don't mean just a head cold. Man, I was sick. So I got on the phone and I called him up and I said, "I hate to tell you this, but I am too sick to fly anywhere." And he was disappointed and I was apologetic. And, you know, I said, "I'm so sorry. I'll see you when you get back." And I hung up the phone and Lance, within 15 minutes, that flu was gone. Gone, like it had never happened.
Uh-huh.
And I, even at the time, as naive as I was then, and this was in my early 30s, I thought, this is very interesting.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You do so much work with kids that have been, that have chosen or who have had difficult times. What are some of the miraculous moments that you've had in this process?
When they show me how old and dumb I am.
No.
That's a miracle.
Huh.
It's a miracle.
Yeah.
No, I think, I don't know if I could even call it miraculous moments, but the last group I worked with, which was a group of young girls at a Last Chance school of a different culture, they were really adversarial. God bless them. I mean, they were just amazing. Every day that we went to work with them, my research assistant and I, was a challenge. But at the very end, we asked them what they had gotten from this process, you know, if anything, because the whole point was to reconnect them to Gaia, Mother Earth, and all of this, and we never got outdoors, we never got to do any of this stuff.
Huh.
And when I brought in, you know, sort of environmental movies, they would be doing their nails and talking to each other and texting on their cell phones and all the rest of it.
Oh, my.
So I thought, well, this is a bust. But anyway, this day came, and so we all were sharing our impressions. And amazingly, these young girls said, well, I learned to appreciate Earth more. I learned to pick up my trash. I learned that a lot of things we do destroy the environment. And one girl said, and I learned that old people can be fun after all.
Oh.
I thought that was a miracle.
Wow. Well, you know, it's a miracle that this time has gone by so fast.
Indeed.
We're almost out of time. I wanted to ask you some more questions, so you're going to have to come back and you know, we'll just continue our dialogue and find out some more about your project with the Native Americans.
Okay, ask me when I get back.
Yes.
Because I'll have some more information.
Yes,
then,
that'll
I'm
be
sure.
wonderful. And I
more
know the listeners.
Learnings, which I hope will not have been too painful.
Oh. be sure, would you like to share with people what your website is? And
it's fine. It's arts.org.
And there's a lot of wonderful stuff on that site.
Well,
and,
hopefully we'll get a little bit more on there.
Maybe you can put the kids to work and have them do some of the artwork.
That would be so lovely. Well, yeah. I'm hoping that when they get done with their film, which is what they are going to create.
Yes.
I know that they will be putting on their own website.
Oh, that'll be so wonderful.
Maybe they will allow us to have some on ours too.
Yeah, that's just a thrilling project. It sure feels like that's a wonderful thing to do, and you do so much good in the community, Valentine.
Well, Lance, I just try. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
at the end
really
of it,
do.
Maybe we'll look back and go, well, this worked, that didn't, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But I really care about kids, and it's important to do what I can to help them, so.
Well, I just really admire you so much, and thank you for being on the show tonight.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for being my friend for over
35
years.
Thank you for being my friend
and
for hanging in
me.
There all these years.
Yeah. I've gained so much from you over the years. So.
Oh, bless you.
You
haven't said a word about your book. That is a tour de force, my dear. That is quite a book.
Oh, you liked it.
I did. It's scary, but I liked it.
Oh, wonderful. Well, in case the listeners are interested in it, I'll throw in a plug for that. It's called, Tales of a Zany Mystic.
There you go.
By Lance White, L.B. White, and it's available at Amazon.com.
Yes, and it is a challenging but a very interesting and very heartfelt read.
Oh, good. So you got through the racy part.
Oh, I got through the race. Hey! I had Annie Mame for my mother. Are you kidding? Of course I got through.
Night, everybody.
Night.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.